Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga.
We'll be gathering at a time when humanity faces huge challenges, from the worsening climate emergency to escalating conflicts, the global cost of living crisis, soaring inequalities, and dramatic technological disruptions.
UN Secretary General on the upcoming UN General Assembly next week as world leaders gather in New York.
It's a situation which is of grave concern, of course, because a school closed means that children lose out on learning. It also means that children are exposed to a great number of risks.
UN agencies say more than 13,200 schools in 8 African nations have had to close because of insecurity affecting the education of at least 2.5 million children.
What is supposed to be a normal scheduled, you know, time of him to go for medical checkups, which is an entitlement to him according to the law of the Republic of Zambia. The government decides that he will not travel.
And Zambia's main opposition party, the Patriotic Front, PF, says it's considering filing a suit against the government for denying former President Edgar Lungu to seek his annual medical review in South Africa. Those and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Some Ethiopians who left the country looking for work want to return home but find themselves stuck in war-torn Yemen. The UN's immigration body is refusing to help the migrants return to Amhara or Tigray due to insecurity in those regions, a decision that has prompted migrants to protest. Maya Miskil reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Hundreds of Ethiopian migrants are stranded in conflict-torn Yemen, unable to work for better wages and without the means to get back to their home. Tens of thousands of Ethiopians head to Arabian Peninsula countries each year, seeking better work opportunities. Often, they undertake a perilous journey and end up being trafficked and stranded along the way. Roman, who first went to Saudi Arabia at 18, says that despite managing to get gainful employment there, working conditions were extremely challenging. She says, there were two of us working together, and then my coworker left. When she left, I was overwhelmed with a lot of work. Roman says there was no rest, and she was not able to eat food. I couldn't even wash my clothes, my feet. After that, she says, I escaped from the house. The International Organization for Migration, which oversees voluntary humanitarian returns from Yemen, recently paused the return of migrants from Ethiopia's Tigray and Amhara regions due to insecurity in the two regions. The IOM cannot stop the migrants from returning to Ethiopia, but is currently not facilitating the return to Tigray and Amhara regions. Ethiopian migrants protested that decision in front of an IOM facility in the Yemeni city of Aden last week, which led to fighting and the deaths of an unconfirmed number of people. Tedros Terfe, chairman of the Amhara Association of America, an Amhara rights advocacy group, says the decision is unilaterally the Ethiopian government's and is a discriminatory policy which has singled out migrants who have Amhara and Tigrayan ethnic roots.
These Ethiopians can be repatriated back to their country and be provided services, housing and other services that they need in Addis Ababa and other parts of the country. Just because they are Amharas, they do not have to return. They do not have to go to the Amhara region. And Amharas live all across all of Ethiopia.
The two-year war in Ethiopia's Tigray region came to an end in November of last year after a peace deal was signed between Tigrayan forces and the federal government. This year, another conflict started in the country's second most populous region, the Amhara region, home to a regional militia known as FANNO. In early August, the Ethiopian government declared a state of emergency in the Amhara region following open fighting. Masai Mulugeta, associate professor at Addis Ababa University, says that in order to dissuade migrants from taking unsafe journeys, there needs to be an economic solution. He says, even though there are other reasons people leave, most of it comes from economic issues. He says if there were job opportunities and if there was a larger economy that could accommodate everyone, then migration might still continue, but it would be possible to be done in a professionally safe way. A recent report from Human Rights Watch says Saudi border guards killed hundreds of Ethiopian migrants and asylum seekers who tried to cross the Yemen-Saudi border between March 2022 and June of this year. The rights group said the shootings could amount to crimes against humanity. The Ethiopian government has announced an investigation into the alleged killings. The Saudi government has denied the accusations. Maya Masakar, VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
The war in Ukraine is likely to be the big topic for a second year in a row when leaders gather at the UN General Assembly next week, but many developing countries are hoping to shine a light on issues important to them, including development, inflation, and climate change. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir has more.
This year's General Assembly is taking place after a marathon month of summits and meetings, and some high-profile leaders are skipping the annual gathering. But there will still be plenty to talk about. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
We'll be gathering at a time when humanity faces huge challenges, from the worsening climate emergency to escalating conflicts, the global cost of living crisis, soaring inequalities, and dramatic technological disruptions. And people are looking to their leaders for a way out of this mess.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is expected to attend in person for the first time since Russia invaded his country in February 2022. It is an opportunity for him to appeal for international support, but he must also walk a diplomatic fine line. Richard Gallen is the director of UN Affairs for the International Crisis Group.
Zelensky does have to be conscious that there are a lot of leaders from developing countries who have problems of their own, such as debt and poor economic growth. And they want to talk about those topics and not just the war between Russia and Ukraine.
That includes sustainable development, which is off track for meeting 2030 targets to end hunger and extreme poverty. The UN says if present trends continue, a staggering 575 million people will remain trapped in extreme poverty by the end of this decade. A two-day summit that the UN hopes revitalizes the goals will begin the high-level week. Astra Bonini is the UN's Senior Sustainable Development Officer.
Progress has been set back significantly in recent years. This is in part due to the lingering drag of the COVID-19 pandemic, the highest level of armed conflict globally since 1945, and climate-related disasters, as well as inflation and the rising cost of living.
There will also be a climate action summit on Wednesday that requires ambitious commitments to cut greenhouse gas emissions and phase out fossil fuels for leaders to get a place at the podium. And the UN Security Council will also meet that day at the highest level to discuss the war in Ukraine. President Zelensky is expected to attend. The Secretary General says there is space to discuss both the war in Ukraine and other pressing issues during the week. He said rescuing the SDGs is urgent. Again, the UN Secretary General.
I believe that there is room for all issues to be seriously discussed. And I am not afraid that the different crises we are witnessing in different parts of the world, that they will take out of the agenda the importance of the FCGs.
President Joe Biden will address the General Assembly on Tuesday morning, laying out U.S. priorities. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield.
He will address the General Assembly, where he will reaffirm our country's leadership in countering threats to international peace and security, protecting human rights, and advancing global prosperity and development.
With much on the line, the world's citizens will be looking to leaders to take action to improve their daily lives and safeguard their future. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Ahead of the UN General Assembly next week, the Democratic Republic of Congo has expressed concern about the humanitarian tragedy and the damage caused by the aggression of Rwanda. In a news conference on Thursday in Kinshasa, Communications Minister Patrick Muyaya and Justice Minister Rose Mutombo accused Rwanda of supporting a rebellion in the east of its territory. They repeated allegations that DR Congo's eastern neighbor, Rwanda, has been backing the M23 rebels, which Kigali has repeatedly denied. UN experts have also accused Rwanda of supporting the rebel force, and in July, the EU condemned the country's military presence in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Last month, Washington announced sanctions against six people, mainly rebel leaders, they said had contributed to the recent escalation of the conflict in eastern DR Congo. Father Jean-Claude Atsemeso is the CEO and president of Congo Minerals USM, and he also founded Jatkik Providence Foundation as part of his efforts to revitalize and strengthen the war-torn Democratic Republic of Congo. I reached him for his reaction to the continued friction between the two countries.
What we are really asking the international community is not because Congo is weak, but is because Congo is willing to keep peace in the Great Lake region. Because if something starts in the Great Lake region, it goes in all those different countries. That's why we are trying to solve it in a peaceful manner. But Rwanda doesn't want to understand things like that. Rwanda wants war, and it has been sending to the Congo infiltrated soldiers in order for them to attack the city of Goma, but also has been sending other soldiers in Congo Brazzaville to attack the city of Kinshasa. And we want, for the last time, to tell the international community that they need to stop the President Kagame doing what he's doing. Because tomorrow, when the Congo will stand and kick back, we don't want them to say that the Congo is attacking a small country, Rwanda, when they have been supporting Rwanda for a long time to do what it's doing. And they never accuse Rwanda, they never shall sanction Rwanda, and all the time when they sanction the people who are really doing nothing. And we want really the international community to do something.
Rwanda continues to deny these allegations, but in August, UN experts accused Rwanda of supporting the rebel force. And in July, the EU condemned the country's military presence in eastern DR Congo. Also, in Washington announced sanctions against six people, as you mentioned, mainly rebel leaders, they said had contributed to the recent escalation of the conflict in eastern DR Congo. Why don't you think that the international community can exert some pressure and resolve this issue?
It's really what you and I don't understand on the international community. Because what Rwanda did to Congo is the same way what Russia did to Ukraine. We saw all the international community went fast to defend Ukraine. But when it's about Congo, they are just playing the game. And we are really, again, inviting them to stop playing the game, to let Rwanda understand that what it's doing, if the Congolese decided to do the same, it's going to escalate violence in the region.
So in your opinion, this accusation and counter-accusation will continue until there's full-fledged war?
In my opinion, is the international community must be responsible. They need to condemn Rwanda they did to you, to Russia. I'm gonna continue to beg the international community, because if they were able to condemn Russia, they are also able to condemn Rwanda.
That's Father Jean-Claude Atsemeso, the CEO and president of Congo Minerals USA and founder of Jatkik Providence Foundation. He spoke with me from Virginia here in the United States. The International Monetary Fund and World Bank will decide on Monday whether to proceed with their annual meetings in October in earthquake-hit Morocco after completing a thorough review of the country's ability to host meetings. IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva told Reuters in an exclusive interview. Georgieva also said the IMF has reached a staff-level agreement with Morocco to provide a $1.3 billion loan to bolster the country's resilience to climate-related disasters from the fund's new Resilience and Sustainability Trust. UNHCR, the United Nations Refugee Agency, as well as UNICEF and the Norwegian Refugee Council said this week that more than 13,200 schools in 8 African nations have had to close because of insecurity affecting the education of at least 2.5 million children. According to the agency's data on school closures over the last 4 years, the number of schools closed in the Sahel region has grown more than fivefold, from 1,700 to 9,000, with Burkina Faso accounting for two-thirds of the closures. Mohamed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
Thousands of schools in Africa have been closed because of insecurity and conflict, depriving at least 2.5 million children of education in the past 4 years, according to a statement from UNHCR, UNICEF and the Norwegian Refugee Council. 13,200 schools have been closed in 8 countries, jeopardizing the future of millions of children. Barnaby Roque, UNICEF West and Central Africa Education Emergency and Resilience Specialist, says the lack of learning institutions poses great risk to the young boys and girls on the continent.
It's a situation which is of grave concern, of course, because a school closed means that children lose out on learning. It also means that children are exposed to a great number of risks, including early pregnancy and early marriage for girls, or potentially recruitment into non-state armed groups for adolescent boys.
School attacks have become frequent, with 147 incidents reported in the region between January and August. According to the US-based Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, which tracks political violence and protests around the world, insecurity has driven families and teachers to flee, disrupting learning for the affected children and communities facing overcrowding and an educator shortage. According to the aid agencies, the situation is particularly dire in the Central Sahel region, where school closures have surged from 1,700 to 9,000, with Burkina Faso accounting for 6,000 of these closures. Burkina Faso is among 6 African nations that have witnessed coups in the past 3 years and faced threats from terrorist organizations. Leonardo Salazar, Regional Education Advisor in Central and West Africa for the Norwegian Refugee Council, says the school attacks reverse progress in keeping children in classes.
Attacks on schools have exacerbated existing structural challenges to education for all, more specifically poverty, poor school infrastructure, low access, insufficient numbers of well-trained teachers. And in some cases, it has reversed decades of well-earned progress for education systems. These disturbances may also lead to diminished quality of education and learning, students falling behind, lower rates of transition to higher education levels, overcrowding and reductions in teacher recruitment. The longer children out of a school, the less likely they are to return.
According to UNESCO, 20% of children aged 6 to 11 are out of school, and 60% of those aged 15 to 17 are not in school in sub-Saharan Africa. The Africa Center for Strategic Studies says 3.2 million people were displaced this year, bringing the total number of Africans displaced by conflict to 40 million, with 31 million internally displaced. Health experts say conflict and violence make children nervous, lonely, or emotionally distraught and aggressive. With the help of locals and authorities, Rook says his organization is creating temporary learning facilities to continue children's education and look after their well-being.
There's a rapid response mechanism which has been created to tend to the needs of these children, which involves staff traveling to the areas impacted by school closure, setting up a temporary learning space in the briefest possible time, and then following up with a greater level of qualitative services, including not only learning, but mental health and psychosocial support for children.
Salazar says there's a need for educational support for children wherever they are and to train more teachers to help students.
It is urgent to increase access to education in areas of displacement and especially in remote and blockaded areas, more specifically in Burkina Faso and Mali. There is a need to accelerate the redeployment of teachers where they are most needed, to open new classrooms whenever possible, and make sure that schools continue to work at the full capacity.
The three agencies are urging governments, rebel groups and militant organizations to uphold the Safe School Declaration, which commits warring parties to protect educational institutions and ensure the continuity of learning, even during conflicts, while reducing the military use of schools. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
Zambia's main opposition party, the Patriotic Front, PF, says it's considering filing a suit against the government. This after the administration in Lusaka declined to allow former President Edgar Chagwa Lungu to seek his annual medical review in South Africa. In response to a letter from the former president, the government declined the request that would enable Lungu to leave the country. But the opposition PF condemned the government's action, saying the refusal to allow the former president to seek medical attention will imperil his life. It adds that it appears to be yet another attempt to intimidate Lungu, an accusation supporters of the government deny. Raphael Nakasinda is the PF's secretary general. He tells VOA's Peter Klote that it's illegal to prevent the former president from seeking medical care.
What is supposed to be a normal scheduled time of him to go for medical checkups, which is an entitlement to him according to the law of the Republic of Zambia, the government decides that he will not travel based on just the fact that the president didn't feel like it. But this is a guy who was just, addressing the nation through parliament, priding himself and boasting that they are restoring the rule of law. But if he, even when there is a law clearly stipulating a particular position, but with impunity people abrogate the law and they try and use state power, quote unquote, which state power basically equally is provided for by the law. They try and use state power to infringe on the rights and freedoms of the former president, including denying him his entitlement. That is not correct. And obviously, as a party, we condemn that with a disdain and contempt that it deserves.
The current administration, to try to find out what happened or to try to engage them to address their concerns to allow him to seek medical attention abroad, since you said it's constitutional and blocking him is illegal by Zambia's constitution.
Well, that challenge has already been, presented. But as it were, even the civil servants that were writing those letters, they know that those letters are illegal. The position they were advancing that those letters and responses are illegal. But these are basically people that are not being allowed to, conduct themselves professionally and take their responsibility professionally.
So let me ask you, what will be the next line of action of the former president? And will he use his own resources to seek medical attention abroad, since this is a yearly review that
we can only,
your party
in
says
this
he
case,
needs?
We can only, in this case, as part of one that is a senior member of the Patriotic Front Party family, try and privately arrange for him to go for medical attention or seek medical attention, because his health is of paramount importance to all of us and to the nation. But beyond that, obviously, is to seek redress, because the law must be applied. The only thing is that the UPND have demonstrated that even when you go to court and there is a court order, they defy the court order. So even the judiciary in the country has been rendered impotent, because their rulings are not being respected by the government, the governing party. We saw that, remember, in the by-election of Kabushi and Kwacha for Honorable Boma Nusamba and Honorable Joe Malanji, where the courts were making decisions, but the other arms of government or institutions were not obeying those court orders and still proceeded to do what the president had ordered them to do.
If you want to seek court redress, but you said the court orders are not being upheld, then how else do you address your concern?
Well, in this case, the only ultimate solution is to have government change. And obviously, the change of government has to come within the confines of the law. So we are up, you know, doubling our steps to engage, of course, the Zambian people to get them ready in terms of being prepared to cast their vote in 2026. Of course, under very difficult circumstances, because every gathering we try to organize, whether it's a rally or an indoor meeting, is being disrupted. So we have to depend on other modes of communication, social media being one of them, and other forms of engagement, so that we get rid of this dictatorship and usher in a government that will be progressive and adhering to all the fundamental principles that will guarantee a healthy, you know, governance system. In this case, you know, upholding the democratic tenets, the rule of law, and the guarantee that people enjoy their freedoms and their rights.
That was Raphael Nakasinda, the Secretary General of Zambia's Patriotic Front, the party of former President Edgar Chagwa Lungu. Earlier this month, police arrested Lungu's wife, Esther Lungu, on charges of theft. In June, they arrested his son and daughter-in-law on charges of money laundering and possessing property suspected of being the proceeds of crime. The Lungu family has denied the allegations. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has announced the successful completion of the fourth and final filling of the Renaissance Dam. Ethiopia believes the massive project will double the country's electricity output, providing a vital development boost as half the 127 million population lacks electricity. Egypt has voiced anger over the announcement and said unilateral filling of the reservoir violated a declaration of principles signed by Ethiopia, Egypt, and Sudan in 2015 and branded Ethiopia's action as illegal. John Mukum Mbaku is a distinguished professor of economics at Weber State University and non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution here in Washington. He has written articles on the dam and is co-author of a book titled Covering the Nile River Basin: The Search for a New Legal Regime. He says Egypt still claims the dam an existential threat to its water security.
The thing is that the Nile is very critical to Egyptian existence. If you look at a map of Egypt, you see that most of the people who live in Egypt live along the Nile River all the way from Sudan to the Nile Delta. And so the Nile is very important to Egypt. During the colonial period, Great Britain signed agreements which were designed to allow Egypt to harness the waters of the Nile for agricultural projects which were beneficial to the British government, primarily the production of cotton. And in 1959, Egypt, a newly independent Sudan, consolidated those agreements into what we now call today the 1959 Nile Treaty. So what the 1959 treaty did was it gave all of the waters of the Nile to Egypt and Sudan. Leaving out Ethiopia, whose highlands produce over 85% of the water that flows into the Nile. This was not really a big problem for Ethiopia because at that time, Ethiopia had not yet developed enough technology to be able to harness the waters of the Nile for agriculture or other uses. However, in 2011, the government of Ethiopia, under the leadership of Meles Zenawi, announced that it was going to construct a dam on the Nile River. That dam was expected to be used for the generation of electricity, the dam that eventually came to be known as the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. This is the beginning of the problems that we now see in the dam, because Egyptians saw the dam as they claimed that it was going to be an existential threat to their water security, to their water rights, meaning the water rights that were assigned to them by the 1959 treaty, which, of course, Ethiopia was not a party to any of those treaties. So that is where we are today.
Professor, so that's where we are today. does the volume of the water, just because the dam is constructed, decrease for Egypt?
Well, what Ethiopia told Egypt when they began constructing the dam was that the only negative impact that the dam would have with respect to water flows to Egypt and Sudan would be during the filling period.
So, Professor, we have the first, second, third, and fourth filling. It's over now.
As far as we know, during the four fillings, as far as we know, there were no significant negative impacts on water flowing into Sudan and Egypt. And I have not seen any reports from either Egypt or Sudan that any one of the fillings involved significant disruptions in water flows. Now the dam's reservoir has been filled. That issue, that is the time needed to fill the dam, is now irrelevant.
And finally, Professor, Sudan, currently mired in fighting between rival armies, did not immediately react to Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's announcement about the fourth filling of the dam. But in a statement on Facebook, the Egyptian foreign minister said Ethiopia's unilateral filling of the reservoir violated a declaration of principles signed by the three countries in 2015 and branded Ethiopia's action illegal.
The 2015, what is referred to as the Declaration of Principles. What the Declaration of Principles did, it was supposed to allow the three countries to choose a group of international experts to study the impact of the GERD on water security in Egypt and water security in Sudan. But that process did not go forth primarily because it brought back the disagreement over the 1959 agreement. That is one of the reasons why, even though the 2015 Declaration of Principles was still in effect, the process did not go forward because of that particular disagreement.
That was John Mkumbaku, a distinguished professor of economics at Weber State University, a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He spoke with my colleague Yahya Swahib from the U.S. state of Utah. In Malawi, civil society groups are kicking against a government plan to extend protection to some public officials, including district commissioners, CEOs of state institutions, and mayors. The move, the group says, is insensitive and a threat to democracy, accusations supporters of the government deny. The groups are questioning the timing and implementation of the plan, contending that the move is too expensive to the taxpayer. They include the Civil Society Coalition, Accountability and Transparency, the Malawi Human Rights Resource Center, and Youth and Society. Charles Kajoloweka is the Executive Director of Youth and Society. He tells VOA's Peter Klote that it's wrong for the government to say the economy is fragile, yet will want to use scarce resources to provide protection for some public officials to the detriment of the rest of the population.
This move by government is not only insensitive to the suffering of millions of Malawians, but also is a threat to democracy and also a potential infringement on fundamental rights. We expect government to take and make decisions or implement policies that are in the best interest of the public. And this policy proposal is not in the best interest of the public. It is petty and it has no any moral basis at all. Our argument and our position is that, one, this is insensitive to the current economic situation that the country is sailing through, and therefore the plight of the citizens should be number one, and not this, a political interest that we are seeing, which is very suspicious in the first place.
Some people are suggesting that, in view of recent developments, including attacks by unknown assailants, these people need to be protected. The district commissioners, the CEOs, and the mayors need to be protected as they serve Malawi.
No, it's not true that, these CEOs are being targeted or these mayors are being targeted. In fact, the most vulnerable people in Malawi are the local citizens, who day in, day out are being attacked because of the lapses of national security. Recently, there have been a spate of attacks against ordinary citizens in the southern part of the country. So it is not true that there is specific security threat to these CEOs or these officials. In fact, what they are going through or the risk and the threats that they face are the very same threats that every citizen is facing in this country. And number two is that even that regard that we are facing these security threats, we don't think this is the right path to take. At the end of the day, the fear is that you are trying to create a monster here, a monster that is not going to be largely accessible to the populace, because by virtue of you surrounding yourself with police officers, you are already sending a wrong message that you are hardly accessible to the people.
The government has more information than ordinary people. The assessment has been made, and that is why the government is planning on this. So if you don't have such information, why wouldn't you approach the government and try to get information on what their bases are, instead of condemning it outright, some people are suggesting?
So in the first place, there is no any assessment that has been done. Therefore, even the proposal is purely ill-informed, because what government is not telling us is evidence. There's no evidence at all. No assessment has been done. And then you have a policy proposal or policy suggestion that is founded on nothing apart from petty and narrow political interest. And we think that the whole program is misguided, because there's no evidence that has been generated, not even assessment that has been done. So what is the basis of a policy when there is no assessment, there is no evidence?
But recently there were the police impounded some containers of refugees or asylum seekers full of all kinds of materials, including weapons. Nobody knows what it's going to be used for, or they are going to be used for. But don't you think that with such events happening, the government had to take precautions to protect people who are working for the government?
No, the primary job of government is to protect the citizenry, to protect the public. And just the way they can protect the public officials. So we are not saying the public officials should not be protected. They have to be protected just like any and every Malawian in this country. And it is also misleading to suggest that the security threat in Malawi is brought in by the refugees or asylum seekers. It is baseless. There is no evidence to that effect. In fact, even the containers that we are leafling through that were opened by police, as we speak today, there have been over 33 containers forcibly opened by the police, and literally these are containers that only contain, grains, legumes.
That was Charles Kajolo-Weka, the executive director of Youth and Society. He spoke with my colleague Peter Klote. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Douglas Impoga, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent. Right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
Back then when we start, nobody no understand that God's plan will be made from the sand. From the feet to the take to the stand, with the hopes that we reach out the land. Everybody don't dress for the occasion. Let we meet at the location. God in wheel not for move, waiting don't go around. No need for come around, we not leaving the rotation.
Yeah,
won't see with the flow, they not get me. Now we back, let them talk and debate me. We not go able to do side of hate me. We not go able to wait till they wait me.
Never enough, we take test us. Whatever we do, we stay blessed. I know when we arrive, we gon' turn up. When we arrive, we gon' flex.
God in move, we didn't move, we didn't move. God in people, then they move. God in people, then they move. We didn't move, we didn't move.
flooding people with the news.
From first of the first, getting money is the cause of the cause. I tell them my God is the source of the source, so I'm not go scared because they go only love you where you high at the peak. They don't know say so you build from the ground up. If you know you work too hard to be treated like you got something to be proud of. Bad energy, I don't remove. Then think I fall, I lost the groove. I don't patapa, you heard the news. The leaves give on, I'm on the move. You never had enough people to test us. Whatever we do, we stay blessed. I know when we arrive, we gon' turn up. When we arrive, we gon' flex. We didn't move, we didn't move, we didn't move. God in people, then they move. God in people, then they move.
Keep it up, get it. Pulse on the track like I'm a
piri pa killer ratavato piri ci piri pa killer ratavana piri ci piri pa killer ratavato piri ci piri pa killer ratavana piri ci piri pa killer ratavato piri ci piri pa killer ratavana piri ci piri pa killer ratavato piri ci piri pa killer ratavana. Your smile and your heart, your love and your cares. Oh, Africa, how beautiful you are.
And we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline Africa team, we say thank you for joining us tonight. For more African news and features, visit our website at voafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. I'm your host, Douglas Impoga, in Washington, wishing you a very good evening.